Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus on Albany. My guest today is my friend Maureen Armand. And Maureen is here to talk about a presentation that will be given called the Cost of War Project. So Maureen, tell us a little bit about this. This sounds really exciting.
Well, Cynthia, I want to be really sure, because if nothing else comes from this conversation, I want to really urge your listeners to go to the website, thecostsofwar.org, okay? And that what the Cost of War Project is a network of scholars, 35 scholars, legal experts, human rights practitioners, and physicians that began in 2011. And it's seated at the Watson Institute of International and Public Affairs at Brown University. And what this is, network, I guess, of researchers came together with the hope that they could feed a debate about the true costs of the wars post 9/11 in Iraq and Afghanistan and the related violence in Pakistan and Syria. They wanted to feed the debate, the public, first of all, to feed a public debate so that there would be one, with true research, scholarly information. And so they have been doing that research, this group of 35 scholars, for the last 8 years, and then writing papers, and a new book has come out, really trying to find powerful ways via their website to make this information available to all of us, to citizens, to political leaders who are making decisions, and to fuel a debate that's really based on accurate information. So all of that to say, it's, I think, an incredible resource for anyone who wants to truly ground their thinking and conversation about these wars that we have been, this kind of endless war framework that we've been engaged in since post 9/11, with real information. That it's just, I find it to be invaluable. And for that reason, the group of women from Women Against War that I work with specifically, we call ourselves the Pathways to Peace Project. One of the things we try to do is to bring speakers who have this kind of information, important information, to help us all think more clearly and to advocate more clearly for our own security as a nation, as a society. We try to bring speakers to the area, and one of the things we always hope to do is to work in collaboration with the local colleges and universities so that this information can come to feed the thinking of students, kind of trying to hand on the baton of thinking about our citizenship in ways that basically will lead us to a more sustainable future. And so for that reason, we were able to work in collaboration with some faculty members at SUNY Albany to bring Dr. Stephanie Savell here this week, who is a research director at the Cost of War Project. And she is going to be speaking on Wednesday, that is November 20th, this Wednesday, at the university at 2:45. And she's going to be addressing a very large group of journalism students. We're working in collaboration with Dr. Thomas Bass, who heads the journalism program, and his partners in the journalism program, as well as to students who are being encouraged to attend through the United University Professors Social Justice, Peace and Social Justice Committee. And so we're, again, happy that we're working in collaboration with faculty members and being able to bring somebody like Stephanie with her information to students. But it also is open to the public, and that's why I'm so happy to have the opportunity to speak to you about it, so that anyone in the area, we're fortunate to have a professor work hard to find a space that's large enough. Anyone in the area who can come out on Wednesday afternoon for this 2:45 talk will be very welcome. Because the title of the talk, and I think it's kind of important to underscore that this is for everyone, is the cost of war, what every citizen, voter, activist, journalist needs to know about the true costs of endless war. That I'm so grateful to have this opportunity to speak with you about it, because I just think that this kind of effort leads to a discussion that is not partisan, it's not political, it's not emotional, but grounded in knowledge that can help us think about the kind of foreign policy we really need. There are articles being written and commentary being made, and I think that this makes this talk very timely, about the fact that a true discussion, a true dialogue about U.S. foreign policy is kind of absent from the presidential campaign, the 2020 campaign. And this is not very sane, given the fact that we stand, as an article recently in Foreign Policy points out, the writer was a man by the name of Jonathan Tepperman, he points out that we perhaps are in a place where the world order is more unstable than it's been in a very, very long time, and that one of the causes for that instability is the failure of U.S. foreign policy over the last almost 20 years. The mistakes that we've made have generated the energy that, in fact, has made the world much more unstable and unpredictable. And for that reason, if there's any issue besides perhaps climate change, in my view, that needs to be front and center in our presidential debate, it is our foreign policy. So having information at our fingertips, both ourselves as citizens and our political leaders, you know, that we can hold their feet to the fire with, about what a sane and actually security-inducing foreign policy would look like is so absolutely essential at this moment in history. So I can't underscore to my mind, and Women Against War, I believe my project group agrees, then this kind of discussion about what have these last 20 years of endless war gotten for us. I don't know if you would be interested, but I could, for example, share with your listeners a few of the most recent papers that the Cost of War Project have written. And I, again, want to underscore that this information is, as part of their mission, is always up front and center on their website so that people have access to it. I don't know if that's of interest. Would that be valuable, Cynthia, if I just went through some recent titles?
Go ahead.
Okay, well, and this is just, you know, from the last couple of months, but it, I think, gives a clear idea of what these 35 scholars are looking at. The U.S. war spending in Afghanistan since 2001. They've been doing research, and they're very transparent with bibliographic information and up front and center where they get their information from. And a summary in the title of that article says that it looks like that's $2 trillion, by the way, the cost of war in Afghanistan. And if I have read this article, and if I'm not mistaken, they also weigh that over and against the human cost and also the lack of security and stability and achievement that represents, that $2 trillion. There's an article that looks very worth pursuing, because this is something that I think scholars have been trying to get at, and maybe only with time do you really get to it. The direct war death toll since 2001 from these endless wars. And again, I think the title uses the word direct very consciously, because there's another way to analyze the human cost of war, and that's the indirect deaths, you know, because of instability, infrastructure destruction, lack of access to necessary life-sustaining resources and so forth and so forth. There are indirect costs, but they've recently published their most recent study on the direct war death toll since 2001, and that's inching up towards a million from the subtitle. Another article, the human cost of post-9/11 wars, and that's, again, written this past year, the direct war deaths in major war zones. So, again, we're trying to disaggregate the information so that they can, so conversation can be fed with very concrete information. Another one that I think is very interesting because it really marries the issue of climate change and militarism as a core driving force in U.S. foreign policy. The title of the article is Pentagon Fuel Use, Climate Change and the Cost of War.
Wow.
I think that's a very valuable article to take a look at.
Mm-hmm.
Another issue that I think that they are constantly trying to study from what I can see is projecting what the implication is of these war costs in a financial way on the U.S. budget. So there's an article, recent article posted, U.S. budgetary costs and obligations of post-9/11 wars through fiscal year 2020. And again, mm-hmm. that doesn't account for projected costs, for example, veterans benefits and so forth, and interest on debt accrued because these wars are put on a credit card, so to speak. So that U.S. budgetary costs and obligations of post-9/11 wars through fiscal year 2020, the subtitle says that looks like, from their research, $6.4 trillion. And again, that doesn't take into account projected costs for already incurred expense from those wars. And then a very specific article, it looks like, the human and financial costs of explosive remnants of war in Afghanistan. You know, trying to really disaggregate through data, you know, where that war has led us in Afghanistan. And U.S. documents themselves and budgetary analysis indicate, in many cases, that it's led us nowhere. That's a discussion for a very large discussion that is worth having as we talk about withdrawal or not withdrawal and the Taliban's increasing control, re-control over the country. So those are some recent articles, and they and I know the latest book that is being published through the Cost of War Project has to do with medical, trying to analyze all the medical implications of these last two decades of war, probably mm-hmm. in terms of direct injury and as well as, projected cost and need of those injured, both civilian and military. So I can't say from my own perspective, and I think from many of my colleagues in Women Against War, how valuable a resource this work that's being carried on through the Cost of War Project is to really reasoned discussion of what kind of a foreign policy we need in order to be actually secure and in our future. In the future we're handing to our children, the students who will be hearing this and their, their progeny down the line. I want to, again, say very concretely that this is open to the public. It's free. It will be in, let me just make sure I give you the correct information. It will be this Wednesday, the 20th, at 2:45 mm-hmm. until 4:05 in Biology 248, which is apparently a new classroom. And it is, if I can just check my notes here for direction, it's on the, I just want to be sure I give you the right information. It's on the east side of the UAlbany Academic Podium. And there's mm-hmm. two nearby parking lots off Collins Circle on the north side of the podium that are easily accessible as a suggestion for people who might want to journey out on Wednesday to attend this talk. Cynthia, what do you think about this? What do you think about something like this Cost of War Project and the scholarship it represents and the sincere effort to ground public debate in true information?
You know, I look at it from a couple of different angles. You know, people talk about the casualties, the deaths, but you know, there's also an insidious, you know, problem because of this, and that's mental and physical harm. You know, people get sick, they get cancer, they get, you know, PTSD, I believe it's called.
PTSD, and
you know, the fact that there are so many wounded people walking around, but yet they're largely ignored. Would you agree?
I would agree, and I really think that that one of the things that really I find valuable and admirable, I think, in this Cost of War project is that it's very clear that what they're trying to ferret out in a very concrete way is the reality of what that human cost look like, both in terms of injury, death, suffering, infrastructure damage, illness that results. So they're looking very carefully and making very clear that, first of all, that human cost is what's totally untenable. But they also want to link that so that for people who see that as not as strong as argument as in fact it is, because in fact it is the argument that underpins all discussion of why war is not the answer, because the cost, the human cost is always too much. But they also work very hard to say, well, what does that look like financially? What does that cost medically look like of people suffering from PTSD, of the injuries that need to be treated, of the psychological damage that is being projected into the future by people who have been psychologically wounded? What is that cost? What is the cost of underpinning a government primarily through bribes and through feeding a class that would, take advantage of the money that we're pouring into, for example, Afghanistan, without stabilizing concern truly for creating a stable government for the citizens who have been so badly impacted from this war. You know, what does that look like coming out of our pocketbook? So that they obviously always make clear front and center the human cost is untenable. Here's what it is. It's untenable given what's been achieved. But also, this is what it looks like economically. And when we talk about climate change and the infrastructure issues that confront us so powerfully, and we say, but there's no money, there's so much money, and it's been poured into a black hole. And they try to make that very clear, and they don't do it in broad brush strokes that I think people can just turn away from. They're trying to disaggregate it so you see it item by item, by item. This is what this is taking out of our capacity to feed true human need, to really build a sustainable future for our future citizens. So I agree. I mean, I think that I love the fact that they make that clear. It's a drumbeat that the human cost is untenable. But here's what it looks like in a pragmatic way, if you need that kind of information. Also, to begin to demand that politically our leadership looks at this information and looks to create a foreign policy that is going to create a sustainable, survivable, secure world.
You know, before the politicians address this, I think us as citizens have a duty, have an obligation to question the elected officials and the candidates, where are you getting your money from? And ultimately, will that be harmful to me? And who is benefiting by the money that you're getting from, you know, your donors? Because nobody questions how the politicians get their money from, And this cycle keeps going on and on and on. And until people question who's funding your campaign and why, I think that's the start of a really good dialogue.
And you know what? And you're absolutely right. And I'm so glad that you're raising this, because one of the things the Cost of War Project says it wants to engender is a democratic discussion. And the discussion is so skewed by the fact that you and I are not standing outside of our senators and representatives' office with easy access. But the arms industry, for example, that exists simply because we have a foreign policy that will be of endless war that assures them profit, they are standing there with easy access. And there are ways to, again, disaggregate that information, and that would be another presentation that we should be actually fostering, I think, Cynthia. And I really appreciate your underscoring that, because, yes, those who profit from war are the ones who are setting the terms of the dialogue. And that's why I can't say enough, an effort like this one, which is really trying to change that dynamic by informing citizens. And I think, again, for citizens to say to our representatives, here's information that's based not on somebody who's going to make money from it, but from scholars who are passionately concerned about the truth. So you're absolutely right. And so, I mean, one of the uses that the Cost of War Project could be put to is by citizens who read the material and find it compelling to share it with their representatives and to insist that they take a look at it, this kind of information, because we need to create a counterforce, a counter voice to those who profit from a policy that is dead-ended and horrific in its costs.
And another thing, for example, like there's a lot of people who dislike Trump, and they keep saying, oh, you know, Obama was great, and we wish we had Obama back. But nobody ever recognizes the fact that he was prolific in drone warfare, and what damage did that cause? And, you know, people have got to recognize what the elected officials are doing and who they are harming.
Right. And, you know, and in terms of, for example, that issue of drone warfare, again, there, and this is, you can study this so carefully. There is that technology represents an industry that stands to and is gaining a massive profit and a policy of using that, actually morally eroding, because maybe that's one of the worst effects of drone warfare for this country. It erodes a sense of morality about our place in the world and our sense of entitlement and that you know, ultimately can only come back on us. You can't approach the world with that sense of the right of the Lord to use technology that is so immoral. But that erosive technology is being lobbied madly. I mean, you know, there. There have been events where drone manufacturers, you know, they're basically right there in Washington providing a conference kind of thing with, you know, this spread of look at this incredible technology that we have to offer. And, you know, like and at the same time backdoor feeding into the campaigns of those who they're trying to entice into saying, yes, this is a valid technology, when in fact it's only something that erodes our security as human beings, and also erodes our morality and our position, our moral position in the world. The whole issue of lobbying and who gets the ear of our leadership, who convinces them, and why they're doing it, is such an important conversation.
And so you and I have been friends for quite a while, and you know we've gone to different things. We've listened to lectures. We've been on the streets together and everything. And when you look around to the talks and demonstrations, unfortunately, and I think I've said this to you before, you see the same people. They're committed people. But what is it going to take for people to wake up and say, hey, I have to join them?
Well, I guess, you know, we have to say over and over and over again, like we're saying for this talk on Wednesday, the door is open. This is for everyone. This is for all of us. And also that's why, you know, we're trying to reach out to the next generation. You know, I mean, this at this talk, we hope there'll be, you know, 60 to 80 journalism students, some of whom hopefully, you know, will have careers that can be influential. And hopefully this kind of information will give them a perspective that will invite them into seeing the world in just the way you're describing, in a much more sane and rational and humane framework, and not drink the Kool-Aid so easily that those who would profit from a foreign policy based on war and militarism and American dominance and ascendancy would have them, you know, be co-opted by. So, you know, I guess that's the hope, you know, that we're always, the hope is that we can reach out, we can break beyond that barrier, we can entice more people into the conversation. I really think, in truth, that most citizens grasp this. And I do think that people feel overwhelmed. One of the things I remember when I first got involved, sadly, too late in my life, but in anti-war activism, was in trying to understand how to get people to oppose the war in Iraq, is that apparently analysts, and it's still true, say that U.S. citizens feel intimidated by foreign policy discussion. It may be true of our leaders also, because the world is a complex place, and it does demand nuance. And it does demand careful thinking and careful analysis and understanding, along with a commitment to peace first and war as the most failed of policies. But the people do feel intimidated and as a result kind of stand back. And I know this was true for me. Who am I to know or to speak about, you know, how we should operate in the world? But in truth, we have to become informed, and we have to believe that part of the democratic process is speaking our mind, and I think our hearts, and I do think that people's mind and hearts, for the most part, eschew war. And I think behind what looks like superficial flag waving, there's an awful lot of concern and an awful lot of understanding, especially in the, based on the wars of the last two decades, that this has gotten us nowhere except indebted and with great human cost and suffering, and, you know, with our place and our position and our esteem very deeply eroded planetary wise. We're not the same shining city on the hill to the world that we might have thought we were.
So give us the particulars of this talk again.
Yes, Dr. Stephanie Savell, who is a research director for the Cost of War Project at housed at Brown University, will be speaking on Wednesday, November 20th at 2:45 at the University of Albany in a large new classroom, biology, and let me just make sure I give you the right number, 248. And this is an open to the public talk, and we would love to see fellow citizens interested in feeding their own understanding of the cost of war there with us and with the students.
Thank you, Maureen. In closing, do you have any final thoughts?
No, Cynthia, I just appreciate the fact that you provide opportunity for so many people in the area who are trying to understand the world, both locally and a broad scale to be able to talk and share. So thank you, Cynthia.
Thank you, Maureen. You've been listening to Maureen Armand. And if you like this show, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, download on your smartphone, subscribe to iTunes. If you have a comment about the show, hashtag Focus on Albany. And I want to give a little plug for what I'm doing. I have created a Facebook page called Women Who Inspire. Like Maureen inspires many. It's Women Who Inspire. It's on Facebook. So if I welcome every woman listening to this to join the group, to be inspired or to inspire. Thank you. Thanks, Maureen. Thank you, everybody.
Okay. Thank you, Cynthia. Could I one more plug?
Of course.
Okay, I'd like to also plug, in line with what you're saying in terms of women who inspire, Women Against War. Again, that's an organization that's a local network of women. It's always open to women, fellow citizens, and men also who would like to work and support. WomenAgainstWar.org is our website, and also Women Against War has a Facebook page. And if you want to meet women who inspire, come and join your efforts to those of your fellow citizens, women who are concerned about war and militarism as in our society. So thank you, Cynthia, for letting me get that last plug in.
Thank you, Maureen. You have a wonderful day.
You too.
And thank you, everybody, for listening.